everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, and you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow, Pullman. Recovery Radio is recorded live at the Latah Recovery Center, located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery. Like I said earlier, I am Radio Johnny, and as far as the calendar goes, we're almost to the end of the month here. You can go online to the LatahRecoveryCenter.org website and pick up the few events that are remaining for this year, and hopefully the January calendar will be posted shortly. But a lot of the offerings repeat. Recovery meetings are usually all pretty standard, so should be able to find what you need there. And today in the studio conference room with me is the fabulous Miss Denise. How are you, Miss Denise?
I'm doing well. Glad to be here.
All right. Well, it's always good to see your smiling face, especially this day after Christmas. So
right.
How was your Christmas?
Christmas was wonderful. It was a great day with family and gifts and all the things. All the good food and just relaxing, good fun.
Well,
how was yours?
Mine was good. It was good. Quiet, as usual. Just me and the whiff hanging out at the house, having good cheer and quiet day. Watching the Hallmark Channel far too much, but
there you
it
go.
Was it was still a good time, and I enjoyed it.
Nice.
So today. The topic we decided on, or I decided on, Denise is always willing to go along
Let's
to get
go
along.
Go with the flow, yep.
is the topic of prayer. And if you go to the Mr. Google and look it up, the word prayer originates from the old English word pries or praise, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong, but which referred to a plea or request, and can also be traced back to the Proto-Germanic word, which I'm not even going to try to pronounce, meaning to ask earnestly. And, I'm sure, some of our listeners out there most likely did some praying over the last few days with the birth of the Christian Savior, Jesus, it's kind of sad that a lot of people don't pray except on these religious holidays. I myself pray pretty much every day because in my mind, God help me, said in the right state of heart, is the most powerful prayer I know. And I need to use it a lot, just in my day-to-day getting along with people. People can upset you, things can happen in the world that are just unthinkable, and even the prayer of God, why, it's a reasonable request, as long as, God, why does this happen, what can I do to make the world a better place, and I've also known people who look at prayer as a meditative state even though they may be agnostic or even atheistic, will use prayer and meditation as a centering practice to help them center themselves and get on with their day. Do you have any rough thoughts on prayer, Ms. Denise?
I do. I was doing a little note-taking so that I don't forget some of the things that I wanted to share on. You caught me. I do. And I'll just quickly say, because I don't know that we're at the point where I'm going to share everything I was going to talk about, but I've found prayer to be very helpful and important throughout my day, in the morning when I need to take some pause time as well. And so I'll share more about that in a little bit. But yeah, I just think, and that can look differently for each person as well, what in particular it means to somebody.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, like I said, for me, it can be a petition, a request for some sort of clarity, which is a big deal to me because, you know, I have a history of making really bad decisions. And to be able to ask, you know, the God of my understanding, which I call a God of my non-understanding, for direction, peace of mind, you know, like the Serenity Prayer says, and I think that's a great prayer. You know, God, grant me the serenity to accept things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It actually goes on longer than that.
It does, and I can't believe I didn't bring it in here, but yeah. I think I have it memorized.
Yeah. So you want to?
Yeah. So start it again.
Okay, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace, taking as Jesus did, the sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that you will make all things right if I surrender to your will, so that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with you forever in the next. Amen. So in that prayer, there's a couple areas that I didn't really enjoy so much first in recovery. And one of them is accepting hardship as a pathway to peace. That was quite a sentence that I didn't really know how to do anything with early on.
Right.
Now, that is a good sentence for me. It's a good part of that prayer where I have made those kinds of things happen and I understand what it looks like to do that.
Right.
It's a positive now.
Right. An example of that for me would be, you know, the hardships that we're all going to encounter, whether you're a normal temperate drinker, non-drug user, whatever, you know, practicing a religious faith of one type or another. But for somebody who is in recovery, it's really important because typically we have to face a lot of wreckage from our past. And in doing so, we grow by facing that, making corrections where we can. And it helps us to understand those, what we in AA call character defects, that inability of ours to know the right thing to say at the right moment, or the having, you know, in addiction, having the inability to, seemingly inability to make good choices because our addiction is controlling everything. You know, our whole thought process, you know, for me, alcohol demanded I drink every day, or it would, you know, unleash all sorts of uncomfortable situations on me. Physical, of course, with withdrawals, but even more so with just that living in that panic state and not being able to live life on life's terms. Mm-hmm. Right? It can just be awful. So, you know, recognizing that hard times are going to come and that you can grow through them. And, you know, I honestly wish I'd had a program when my parents died because both of those cases were tragic, one from cancer, one from cirrhosis, and it was really ugly to watch. And if anything, it just drove me deeper into my addiction because I didn't have a healthy way to deal with it. And I didn't understand that something positive is going to come out of this. Not necessarily good, but something positive. I will learn something through this process. So tell me, what thoughts do you have along that line, or exemplary
I was actually thoughts? Sharing this morning about how I didn't grow up understanding or having the concept that change is something that people do to evolve and different kinds of things like that, and that it can be such a positive thing. And then I do understand now and can see in my life where the changes that I've made in recovery have been just so beneficial. And in recovery, I've learned how to deal with hardships like loss and change and hard family things, so many things. And it was my struggle with substance use disorder that brought me, you know, to a point where I had to make a change. It was, you know, either make these changes for 2 years through the program that I was in or go to jail or prison, you know? And that just did not seem like an option to me at all.
Not a good one.
No. Certainly. And it was this hardship that I had been going on for 12 years of just really being in a dark place, doing things that one shouldn't put in their body. And then from that, just destroying myself and everything around me. So there was a lot of hardships. And like you shared, there are some things that are still being dealt with from them or dealt with. There's still things that come up now that are from then.
Mm-hmm.
But I now have community and understanding and tools and just a better way of living my week and boundaries and just all these different kinds of things that have been built into my life that were never there before. They were never there before.
Right.
You know, that's a lot of things. That's a lot of tools and like understanding how to live life in a healthy way that we're just missing. So now I can look at that and it does bring me a smile to my face and a peace inside. Oh, and the other thing that I was thinking as you were sharing was these hardships and hardships in general now can humble me to lots of things, to myself, you know, different things that I've done and being kinder to myself, being kinder and more empathetic and understanding towards others and gentle. You know, there's definitely a gentleness about how I parent now versus how frustrated and things that I used to get. I mean, there's just so many different things and examples. Yeah.
So, yeah, speaking to that, the humbling yourself, it kind of reminds me back to the 11th step of my program, which tells me to pray only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. And mm-hmm. God's will for me might be to do nothing, that whatever I'm praying about is something that's out of my lane and that I should not be trying to deal with it, you know, or fix it.
Right. It might not be in the right timeline even.
Right. Men try and fix things. I mean, that's kind of our nature, you know, which is why when women come to us and are talking about a certain thing that's bothering them, we offer to try and fix it. And that nothing is more infuriating to my wife, at least, than me trying to fix something for her, because that's not what she's after. She's after somebody to listen to what's going on with her and, you know, just help her be okay with it in that sense. But the idea of asking for what God's will for me is also very powerful because, you know, I have been shown by example, you know, over time that, you know, God does not want me to be the guy with all the answers. He doesn't want me to let my ego get so big that I think I'm him. but he wants really good things for me, like the ability to stay sober so I can help somebody else along that path through my experiences, good and bad. And so that, you know, it humbling, yes, it can be very humbling. Not to be confused with humiliating. It always cracks me up that that I used to equate being humble with being humiliated because I didn't understand what humbling myself before someone else meant. I thought that meant that, you know, I became a doormat to somebody else, which is not true. Mm-hmm. And even in the AA literature, it says, you know, we're God's people. We don't bow down to anyone. So, you know, hearing that's also a little confusing. It's like, well, wait a minute, you know, where's the line between being humble and being a doormat? Well, it's explained later on.
Yeah, it is. It's in there. It's just maybe not right there.
Right, yeah. Right, mm-hmm. Right. Well, being humble, you know, is being able to accept things as they are, like the prayer says. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, being willing to accept things as they are.
It's a broken world.
Changing the things I can, right. You know, might mean humbling myself to, you know, my boss and saying, yeah, I've really been kind of a dork about coming in late, you know, consistently, mm-hmm. and I need to fix that.
Taking,
you know,
responsibility.
That can be a real humbling experience.
Taking responsibility definitely is a humbling thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I think that the people around us need to see that, especially after, at least for myself, the years of not being respectful to others, you know?
Mm-hmm. And not being responsible maybe to yourself.
Right, because I wasn't respecting myself.
Right.
And that's some of what I share with people when I talk with them is, you know, when they're interacting with someone who's still actively using is, I mean, I wasn't respecting myself when I was using. I really wasn't. Mm-hmm. I was off, you know, doing these things and my priorities were way out of order. And so I really wasn't going to respect others, and I really wasn't going to be good to myself, and I wasn't going to be good to others. That's at least myself.
Right.
When I look back, that's what I see partly. Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. You know, when we're active in our addiction, we're also in full-blown ego, you know, and my ego can put me in a state of flight from reality. I have convinced myself that drinking a quart and a half of hard liquor in a day is okay. You know,
I'm sure you had lots of reasons to that too.
Oh yeah, exactly. Well, mainly just because the sun came up, you know, maybe. Well, it depends.
Did you need it to like function and go about your day and be productive and
right.
whatever, or you deserved it, or those? Right. I feel like there's all sorts of different reasons why we each, yeah.
Oh yeah, no, you're mm-hmm. absolutely right. I mean, you know, my rationale for it, you know, I'm sure is different than everyone else's. But when it comes to finally, you know, recognizing the denial that you're living in, or that I was living in, I'll speak in I-me terms, that I was living in, mm-hmm. it struck me like a lightning bolt. I mean, I didn't have a burning bush moment, you know, in the classical sense where a bright light came in the room and said, you need to quit drinking, dummy. Mm-hmm. It would be a great story, but, you know, for me, it was just, you know, this still quiet voice in my head that made me say out loud, God, I can't live like this anymore.
You came to your, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I honestly believe that, you know, that was a prayer, even though I didn't realize it or recognize it as a prayer. And, you know, the only proof I need that prayers get answered was the fact that the next day I woke up and I wasn't filled with an overwhelming sense of dread about being able to get another drink.
Yeah, that's a really huge thing.
You know, I mean, my body was screaming for it. Mm-hmm. My mind was screaming for it, but something was saying, no, you'll be okay. You know, mm-hmm. And it's like I've heard so many people in my program say that, you know, I got into AA because God picked me up by the nape of the neck and put me in a chair here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have to admit that, you know, once things started clearing up and I'm like, what am I going to do about this? Because, you know, I've been able to stay sober for a few days at a time, maybe right. even weeks, maybe even a couple of months, but it didn't change the way I thought about it. So mm-hmm. my first real clear thought was, well, my mom got sober in AA. And I never thought that would happen.
Right.
So maybe that's where I need to go.
And that's part of what it takes is just like knowing one person that, and what they, one thing that they did,
mm-hmm.
literally just like one thing.
Right.
You know, I mean, I had that one thing. I knew somebody who went here to Weeks in Vitry,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the drug court program.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that was one of the first things I asked when I, you know, got to talk to my lawyer and stuff when I'd gotten
right
putting a timeout, you know,
putting a timeout.
Yeah. Oh, I needed a timeout. And so same thing, you know, like what you're sharing with your mom. So, and that's why it is important. That's part of why we're here sharing about stuff. Why we have people come on the show mm-hmm. is because there needs to be one person with one thing that they did in their path of mm-hmm. recovery. And everyone needs to hear about it. Like everyone needs to know at least one person.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, when that brings up another thought, I'll wander down this bunny trail. You know, there's a lot of talk about what they call interventions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, interventions are great for letting people know that you care about them and that you see, you know, their life going off the rails and, you know, the potential for them to die from whatever disease they're suffering from. And that's great, and that can make a impression on people. But I can't tell you how many people I've met who have had those interventions, and as soon as the noise died down, either they stop using whatever their drug of choice was, alcohol, whatever, once the noise calmed down, the heat was off, they go right back to where they were because it wasn't that personal decision
yeah.
to make a change. That observation, that self-observation that, hey, this isn't working like it used to. Because alcohol worked great for me for a lot of years, you know, loosened me up. I was a little more gregarious, a little more outgoing, able to get up on stage in front of people and make a fool of myself, you know, for their enjoyment. And, you know, that was great. But that's not where I was mm-hmm. at the end. At the end, I was, you know, isolating, full of fear and dread, and, you know, participating in life only at a minimal level, just to be able to protect my addiction. So, yeah, it seeing where someone has gone, I mean, I can't speak for everyone. I can just speak from the experience of other people that I've heard. But it seems to me that once somebody gets a head full of AA or NA and they try and go back out, it's a miserable experience. Mm-hmm. I've seen it just recently at my meetings, like three or four folks that were in for a length of time, you know, a substantial length of time, years, mm-hmm. and got away from the program, life's going good, whatever. And then they found themselves, you know, struck drunk or using again, and it's miserable from the get-go, because for an alcoholic like me, if I were to start drinking today, I wouldn't work my way up to the way it was when I stopped. within days, I'd be back at that, you know, fifth and a half of hard liquor a day. It's just the nature of the disease. Mm-hmm. You know, those receptors that are in my brain that I developed and multiplied doing alcohol are still there. And as soon as they get a hold of some more of that feel-good, you know, dopamine, they're going to start screaming again, and I'll have to meet their demands. That's just the way I'm wired. You know, it's unfortunate, but that seems to be the gig, at least for me. And I think a lot of other people too. They've shared that with me. Mm-hmm. So, but back to your point of just knowing, you know, maybe somebody's listening to this program today who's, you know, just gotten through Christmas. Maybe you're suffering from what I like to refer to as a sucking head wound from maybe a little too much eggnog or whatever. And, you know, maybe you're rethinking, you know, was it worth it? Or, you know, is this thing becoming the thing in my life rather than just a thing? Because let's face it, most people in the world can have a couple of drinks and, you know, enjoy themselves, even, you know, with recreational drugs. I mean, I can see that. I never found myself, you know, lying, cheating, and stealing to get cocaine, but I used it, and it was fun. And along with other, you know, other substances as well. But, you know, for me, alcohol was it. I mean, it made everything right. The first time I drank as a child, it was happy times, you know. I don't know how was it for you when you first, you know, experienced an opioid?
Yeah, so the first time, just briefly, was actually when I had my first daughter, and I was in the hospital, and they gave me some Demerol, or is there a kind called Demerol? Dilaudid? Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
And I looked to my mom, and I said something basically meaning like, this is really great, you know? I didn't last very long, and then, of course, you know, I'm having a baby, so, right. You know, whatever. But then later in life, in my later 20s, as I was starting to have more and more problems with my spine stuff, I had gotten a prescription from the hospital and made that last like 3 months. It was probably only like a 2-week prescription, you know, and I made it last a really long time. But then I wound up being around people who had those and they were selling them so they could buy weed instead because they didn't want those, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it didn't take, I mean, it took a little bit, but then I was doing them every single day, you know? And what was happening was I wasn't making the changes that I needed. I just wasn't sure how to deal with this. I was trying to continue to work. Mm-hmm. I kept having problems, and I just didn't know what to do with it. And then eventually it was as an everyday thing, and then it moved into, you know, harder kinds of like Oxycontin and different kinds of things like that, and it became pretty serious. And then when you don't have those things and you're sick, you know, and it's just a mess. So I mean, it didn't take too long to progress into a big train wreck that was real expensive, illegal, and it was just really hard on my body, honestly, you know?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, so, I mean, like now, I mean, I had spine surgery and I did use the medicine that they gave me afterwards as prescribed. Mm. I did finish up a couple of days before I had run out and it was okay. Mm-hmm. And I think I shared before, I remember thinking like at the sixth or seventh day, I was like, man, this still really hurts. Mm-hmm. And I was getting worried. I really was. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't want to ask for more, you know? But then it was like literally within 24 hours. And I remember kind of like praying about it and just really being concerned with God. I was just like, this is, I'm scared. And then within 24 hours, I kind of turned a corner with it. Mm-hmm. And then it got better within the next 2 days where I was able to just take Tylenol and my muscle relaxers and it was fine. And I think the only other time before that might've been, can't remember. I think I had some. I think I had a, some teeth things. No. I know what it was. I had something internally rupture.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a few days of something from the hospital. Mm-hmm. And again, and both of those times, all it did was make it to where I was okay pain-wise, mm-hmm. but I was still just in bed, like not doing well as far as like
right.
what I was recovering from. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to go back to the life that I lived with that. Mm-hmm. It sucked.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, yes, it was fun in the beginning, but eventually it hurts so many people. There's so much pain in my heart and so many things that I know affected my family and stuff. I don't want to feel like that anymore.
Right.
I don't want to like actually bodily feel that kind right. of stuff anymore, mm. emotionally or physically. It just yeah. sounds awful.
Yeah.
Not that I put myself in any kind of situations where I'm around things that would be bad for me.
Right.
And that's a big key thing. I really feel for you and for others that struggle with alcohol in the sense that it's at the grocery store.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's hard. I remember my first couple of months in my program and there was no drinking for, you know, the 2 years and I would walk down the aisle to go get milk and I just would look and I was like, oh, wow, I'm really glad that this isn't like aisles of opiates, you know, or other things.
Right.
That are illegal.
Right.
You know? So I gained some respect within the first couple of months of, I did go to some AA along with my NA stuff. Mm-hmm. And part of that was to just kind of like, cause I had to go every day for 90 days. But what else it did was it helped me to understand other relatives in my family. My grandfather, who I just was never around. I think the last time I saw him, I was 7. Mm-hmm. I heard struggled with alcoholism. And during early in my recovery, I really had like some heart-to-heart prayer and forgiveness to him because mm-hmm. I started to understand what he was going through
mm-hmm.
and other family members of mine. I was able to forgive them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really great to attend AA and sit and listen to what was going on and
right.
kind of have that time to have compassion.
Yeah.
And understanding.
And you know, one of the fellows in AA, typically almost every share he gives out during a meeting, he points out to the fact that, alcohol was not the problem. His mind was the problem.
Exactly.
And that's significant because, once I removed the alcohol, I was still crazy as a crap house squirrel. So that indicated to me that there was something wrong there that, you know, wasn't caused by the alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the alcohol colored decisions I made, but the fact that I thought of those things, you know, the fact that I had to keep lowering my standards and my morals to be able to drink the way I wanted to, you know, that was not something that alcohol conjured up in my brain. That was me. That was my mind altering, you know, the reality to, you know, maintain that good feeling that I got from alcohol.
Yeah, it was like was it kind of like falling on like a more.
Yeah.
I remember hearing something like, it's like a more thing.
Yeah. Well, and even
if this is good, let's have more.
The Lotto principle. If a little is good, a lot will be better.
I tended to overdo things too when I was,
Even as a child, you know, if I got a train set for Christmas with 6 cars, I wanted mm-hmm. more cars. If I got a cookie, I wanted 3. So it was, you know, a kind of thinking that I was born with.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, as I observed the world around me growing up, you know, it's like, well, if you want more, you just take it. And that's wrong.
Right.
You know,
I feel you there.
Nothing about working for it or whatever. Mm-hmm. Although I did that too. But, you know, getting back to, you know, the mindset that, you know, why I drank. There are people I know in the program who will scrub packaged food, you know, like a TV dinner or something like that, you know, or one of these, you know, quickie microwave meal things. They'll scan it to see if there's like wine in it because they feel that, you know, any kind of alcohol in any form at all.
You can cook with alcohol.
Yeah. Okay. Well, cool. Or could trigger them, even though it's being cooked out.
Sure.
Cold medications. One of my favorites, NyQuil.
Yeah.
I mean, it not only helps me sleep, but it decongests my head and everything else. You know, it's got alcohol in it. You know, I still take it when I need it, but like you were talking about, you were taking these opioids in sobriety for the reason you're supposed to be taking them.
Exactly. And I wanted to expand on that just for a second for anyone who's listening.
Sure, absolutely.
So, because I didn't really expect to share that, but so I want to tell everyone this, because I don't want to come off sounding like, oh yeah, you know, no big deal. So when I got into recovery, I let my doctors know, every doctor that I dealt with, you know, I'm in recovery. I would explain, I would answer any questions. When I started working with the medical professional that was going to be doing my surgery and my hospital and everything like that, I mean, we talked about these things. People knew. I talked with someone at my work as an accountability work person, you know, my family, my daughter, and things like that, my adult daughter. And I let them know what the plan was with this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was very upfront. And so if anyone noticed anything off with me, they would know to jump in. Like they had my permission to do this. And I remember specifically, like my adult daughter was actually concerned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was her big concern, was that, you know, this wouldn't be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and so if anyone's in this kind of situation, I would say really be mindful of remembering to be honest, to have accountability people that you talk to leading up to these kinds of things, if you can. I realize some surgeries just happen. And talking with your doctors and stuff, and just being honest and talking things through, you know?
Right, exactly.
And I wrote down everything I took at the time I took it and everything, kept it right there by my bed so that I could see, so I didn't mess up. I had everything like laid out nice and organized.
Right.
And if anyone, like if my daughter came over and she was worried, like, you know, it's just all right there. Mm-hmm. You could see that things were being used appropriately and stuff like that. But
right.
I wanted to be very transparent about it.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I'm doing. This is why. These are the guidelines and the plan. And I let probably five people in my life know that I was doing this.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's...
And my doctors.
Right, right. And I've always been very upfront with my doctors. As a matter of fact, I had one doctor who's no longer in the area, so I can talk about them, who, when I explained, you know, I'm a recovered alcoholic, you know, I can be sensitive to drugs, but that was never really my thing. And I said, you know, just so you know, if you ever have any questions about how alcoholics think, or, you know, if you feel you're getting, quote, played by somebody, you know, feel free to reach out to me. Feel free to reach out to me if you want me to just talk to somebody. That's okay, too.
Mm-hmm.
And this doctor said, well, you know, at this clinic, we don't like working with those kind of people. And I laughed, and she looked at me kind of funny. It's like, what? And I'm like, oh, I said, you have no idea. You'll probably see two or three alcoholics today. You'll never know.
Mm-hmm.
We are so good at hiding it. So, it's important to me to, you know, be honest and straightforward. I'm currently on a regimen of, addictive pain medication for my absolutely destroyed spine that nothing can be done about. You know, I would happily accept surgery, but from what I've been told with the, you know, the arthritic condition that I deal with every day, they can go in and scrape it out and it grows right back.
That's what I was going to say. That's actually like, a one that you're kind of just, from what I understand, kind of stuck with.
Yeah, you are. I mean,
that's what they told me too.
If there was like a big stenosis or something that was, you know, hammering a disc or poking into a nerve, yeah, I would say, yeah, if you can go and just take care of that one, you know, so I can feel my leg again, that would probably be fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, being on a medication that initially, you know, knowing that, okay, this is an addictive medication. And in reality, physically, I probably am addicted. If I stopped, I'm sure I would have withdrawals. You know, because I've even cut back and felt some, you know, little minor withdrawal things. But, you know, I use it when I need it. And initially, when I got on this stuff, my wife was concerned. So I gave her the medication, and she would dose out, you know, a daily dose for me. Mm-hmm. And that was fine. And we did that for, I don't know, over a year. Mm-hmm. And finally I said, you know what? I'm a big boy now. I think I need to, right. Now that I know I'm not.
And your doctor
worked
with you on this.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And we talk about it. I meet with him every 6 months mm-hmm. to go over this primarily. You know, I'll be coming up on going to my annual turn your head and cough thing in a week or so. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll talk about it for sure. And he doesn't seem concerned with it. I think he knows I'm being a straight shooter with him. He has had alcoholics in his life, so he knows how they are and how to deal with them. Yeah. In other words, he's real good with his BS detector, and I've never tipped it off. Mm-hmm. So we have a good relationship that way. Good. You know, and that's the important part. And like you said, you know, you had major surgery. There's a good reason for having those.
Yeah,
good reason for having good, strong pain medication. I mean, I can't imagine my mother when she was dying from her cancer. It was incredibly painful. And the only thing that offered any relief was like straight morphine. And it don't get no stronger than that. Well, I guess fentanyl is, but I mean, and even then, she never went over any kind of crazy line. Of course, she was in the hospital and was being monitored, but right. I mean, when she said the pain was getting too bad, they gave her a shot. And so, I mean, there's a reason for those drugs to be around, and we shouldn't be, I don't think we should be frightened of using them if we're in, and now here we go back to AA, we're in a fit spiritual condition, which is why I think you were able to take them as prescribed.
Right.
And
10 years in recovery. Yeah.
Being thoughtful of mm-hmm. the people around you, because those are the people we hurt the most, you know, during our addiction.
Yeah.
And, you know, being transparent like you were. And also being able to use the medication for what it was, you know,
intended.
Designed for.
Yes.
You know, which mm-hmm. in the beginning with you were doing, but a switch flips in our head.
Yeah.
It's just, like, if I feel good, like you said, the more thing, if one feels good, you know.
Right. If there's an endless supply that's not coming from a doctor.
Right.
Because doctors aren't endless supplies.
Right.
You know what I mean? This was an endless supply back then, basically, of just being able to buy them.
Right.
There was no supervision. There was no accountability.
Right.
There was just,
Was just Denise and her pain, whether it was physical or emotional.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Speaking of physical and emotional pain, actually, this has nothing to do with it. We're just about out of time here.
That's
do you have
fair.
Any final thoughts on prayer, which I think is where we started?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. I was just going to say that my personal stuff is, you know, I like to pray in the morning. I like to pray for my friends, family, my town, my country, the world, the leaders, my requests, things that I'm struggling with, things that I would like some help with. Things around my heart, and I also pray for my enemies. And I also suit up in with Ephesians 6:10, the full armor of God. And those kinds of things are really important to me. I also like to either read or listen to things that have to do with the Bible, because I like learning more, and exercise in the morning, and, you know, meditating and things. And also throughout the day, especially when days are hard, I really need to pause and just take some time. And that can look like prayer or just relaxing and doing some self-care. Mm-hmm. You know, it's important for me to be mindful of when my shoulders and stuff are tensing up, or I'm just like, I know I've had a hard conversation with somebody, mm-hmm. and I need to pause before, for myself and for the next person that I'm going to talk to, and for my family that I'm going to go home to later. You know what I mean?
Right.
Just being self-aware has been so helpful in my life.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. And that, and like I said, for my friends that were atheistic, you know, that time in prayer or meditation helps them accomplish that.
Exactly.
To, you know, right. be centered.
This is a human thing.
Relaxed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and to rethink where you want to be in life. You know, do you want to mm-hmm. be angry and upset with people all the time, or do you want to be kind and more patient? You know, and prayer is a real great way to accomplish that.
Agreed.
So.
Thank you, Johnny.
Well, thank you, Denise. I guess we kind of ran down a rabbit hole there, but it's all useful. So, you know, like they say in AA, take what you need and leave the rest till later.
Absolutely, yes.
You can always come back and get it. And I'll close it off with our usual, you know, if you think you have a problem with substances or behavioral health, you do.